Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to today's webinar being conducted by Winston and Strawn. Our topic for today is Spotlight on Labor Markets, Antitrust Considerations for No Poach and Wage Fixing Agreements. My name is Ava Cole. I am the co-chair of Winston and Strawn's Global Antitrust and Competition Practice Group. We are a full-service antitrust shop with approximately 65 full-time lawyers throughout our offices worldwide. Presenting with me today is my colleague and friend, Kevin Goldstein. He is of counsel in our Chicago office. Among other things, Kevin and I both handle antitrust litigations and investigations, including in the context of no poach and wage fixing, which of course is the subject of today's webinar. Before we jump in, just a couple of notes about CLE credit. If you are interested in obtaining CLE credit for California, Illinois, New York, or Texas, we have created an electronic procedure to collect documentation on attendance. Yesterday, you were sent an email that contains a link to a CLE evaluation form. And during today's webinar, we will mention and show a presentation code. Please make note of that code as you will need it to fill out your CLE activity evaluation form. Once you have completed that form, we can send you a certificate of attendance. So, without further ado, let's jump right in and move to the first slide. Gone are the days when agreements among employers not to poach or solicit each other's employees flew under the radar. In December of 2020, the DOJ obtained its first criminal indictment for wage fixing, and prosecutions of collusion in labor markets are likely to ramp up. Acting Assistant AG Richard Powers, he's the acting head of the DOJ Antitrust Division, has noted that criminal cases that focus on labor markets are an increasingly significant and active part of the antitrust division's docket. And he has recently confirmed the administration's commitment to investigating and prosecuting per se illegal collusion in the no poach and wage fixing space. There are headlines galore on this subject over the past couple of years, and it is only increasing. Both no poach and wage fixing agreements have become a major focus not only of U.S. antitrust enforcement regulators, but also of private litigation. There has been, as we all know, an increased bipartisan interest in increasing antitrust enforcement. So we expect to see a continued focus on labor markets across all sectors. Healthcare is one in particular, but across all sectors, we expect that this trend will continue. Let's move to the next slide. So what are we going to talk about on today's webinar? Here is the roadmap. We're going to start with the basics. What are no poach and wage fixing agreements? What are the legal standards for no poach and wage fixing claims? We're going to talk a little bit about recent developments in civil government enforcement and private litigation. And then we're going to spend a little bit of time on the DOJ's first criminal prosecutions. And we will end with best practices and things to think about for minimizing risk. Next slide. And we can advance once more. Thank you. Okay, elements of no poach and wage fixing agreements. These are the basics. You have to have an agreement, as with any antitrust agreement in connection with any other area. Among competing employers, and we'll talk about what that means, to limit or fix the terms of employment for potential hires, that constrains individual firm decision making, so you're not making your individual decision for your own company's best interest, you're doing it collectively with some other company. And it's with regard to wages, salaries, or benefits, terms of employment, or even job opportunities. No-poach clauses in particular, let's start with those, can appear in various contexts. We see them in settlements to resolve business disputes. We often see them within employment or severance agreements. You can see them in vendor contracts or other supplier customer contracts. We see them in joint venture agreements. We might see them in M&A lead-up agreements. And you may see them in other contexts as well, as ancillary agreements to other legitimate collaborations. No-poach agreements can take many different forms. Typically, they're agreements with another company not to solicit or to hire another company's employees. But it can also include agreements that limit employee mobility in other ways, like agreements not to cold call your employees, others' employees, not to recruit certain categories of employees, not to permit switching across companies, to give notice to another company or to get approval before hiring an employee, or to require certain prerequisites for employment, and that would be something that would be agreed upon with another company. So we see these no-poach agreements in lots of different contexts, and they can take many different forms. Let's move to the next slide. Wage fixing is specifically focused on compensation, but again, it's broad because it can include an agreement that affects any element of compensation. We're not just talking about base salaries, but we're talking about overtime, sign-on incentives, any type of bonus, including a discretionary bonus, stock, cash, agreeing or not to give counter offers. It can include deferred compensation, benefits, really anything at all that affects the value of compensation can go into this bucket of wage fixing agreements. Let's move to the next slide. I mentioned that we would come back to this concept of competing employers. So what does it mean to be a competing employer in the labor wage fixing no-poach context? From an antitrust perspective, we're not necessarily talking about employers that operate in the same industry. What we're really talking about is firms that compete to hire or retain employees from the same employment marketplace. So it doesn't matter if you're making the same products or competing to provide the same services. It's really you're a competitor with another company in the labor context, so long as both of you look for the same type of employee in the same geographic area. There is the potential, unfortunately, for massive criminal and civil exposure in this space. Most critically, and what we'll talk about a little bit later, the DOJ can bring criminal prosecutions against individuals who have been involved in setting agreements in this area against the company or both. Federal antitrust agencies can and do often also bring civil enforcement actions. State AGs can bring civil actions. Employees can file civil lawsuits, including in the form of class actions, which, as we know, are quite burdensome and expensive to defend against. In the civil lawsuit context, plaintiffs can seek treble damages and attorney's fees. And even when a company is ultimately successful on the merits, a company really does face significant litigation costs and reputational harms if even faced with this type of complaint or investigation. So let's move ahead now to the legal standards for no-poach and wage fixing claims. And we can advance to the next slide, and I'll turn it over to Kevin to handle the next piece.
Thanks, Ava. So as Ava was saying, proof of agreement is necessary for most of the claims we see in the no-poach or wage-fixing conduct context. That's because the claims are traditionally brought under Section 1 of the Sherman Act, which deals with agreements between two actors. That's usually, you know, in distinction from Section 2 of the Sherman Act, which deals with monopolization, unilateral conduct. So you have to have an agreement for the types of claims we normally see. An agreement doesn't need to be a formal contract. It can be really any meeting of the minds. It can be wink, wink, nod, nod. It can be totally silent as long as there is an understanding and that can suffice. But again, unilateral decisions not to compete are not violations of Section 1 of the Sherman Act. So if two companies independently come to the same conclusion that it's in their interest not to poach each other's employees, and they do that without an agreement between them, that's not a violation. Of course, sometimes it can be a little murky when there's parallel conduct that's not really an agreement, and that's certainly something we spend a lot of time fighting about in our litigations, but we can look a little ahead as we go on to the next slide. So we've put some hypotheticals in throughout the presentation, and we'll come to a few of these, and they're designed to tease out certain points, but we'll also invite any participation if anybody has thoughts or comments during these. So the first hypothetical we have is involving parental leave. Now, as Ava said, it doesn't have to be an agreement on wages. It can be any term of employment that's at issue here. So Allie from Company A mentions to her friend Betty at Company B that she has been working on a new parental leave policy. Betty wants to be helpful and offers to send Allie Company B's policy. Company A was debating whether it should extend paid leave, but she chooses not to after Allie learns Company B is not doing so. So the question here is there a violation? We have limited facts, but I think one of the things we want to tease out here is there are no facts in here that say there's actually an agreement between Company A and Company B not to extend paid leave to set a certain parental leave policy. So that is a helpful fact to suggest there may not be a violation here. But as we were setting up this hypothetical, it's not entirely without risk. Although parental leave policies are frequently something that's public, that employers tout or put in job listings, that doesn't seem to be the case here. A got the information from B, not from a public source. And as a result of that information exchange, did adopt a less favorable leave policy than they might otherwise have. So you maybe don't have a Section 1 violation if there's not an agreement. But there are other claims sometimes brought for information exchange issues. You can see claims under the FTC has brought claims under Section 5 of the FTC Act. And you also see cases where you might have a complaint that does try to bring out a Section 1 claim and kind of alleges these types of facts to support it. Ava, any further thoughts on this hypo? I know we were discussing before.
No, I think that's all right. I think the bottom line is, and the key takeaway, and we'll get to some of these at the end, but the key takeaway is that any discussions with other companies about what you're doing in terms of your compensation structure and your benefit structure can be risky. So you have to make sure that your employees, and particularly your HR employees, know to be careful and to make sure that at the end of the day, you're making decisions independently in terms of the best interests of the company.
Going on to the next slide now, we'll dive in a little deeper. So when we look at the no poach wage fixing claims, the law generally draws a distinction between two broad categories. You have naked agreements and ancillary agreements. A naked agreement is Company A and Company B are just competitors in the market for labor. They have no other relationship between them, and they reach an agreement not to poach each other's employees, to set a wage, not to solicit each other's employees, any of the types of agreements we're talking about. It's just a naked agreement. On the other hand, you have ancillary agreements. An ancillary agreement is where it's ancillary to some larger other legitimate collaboration between Company A and Company B. Maybe they have a joint venture between them. Maybe one is a supplier to the other and the other is a distributor. Maybe there's a consulting arrangement. It can be a number of other relationships. But in that context where you have another legitimate relationship, then you may have some agreement that affects hiring or employment terms moving between the two companies. And the law treats these naked versus ancillary agreements very differently. So we'll talk about that more. On to the next slide, we'll talk about naked agreements. So naked agreements are judged harshly under the antitrust laws. They are treated as per se illegal, meaning they are just illegal. The courts will not really entertain much of a defense. If there is an agreement, then it's a violation. You don't get to say, oh, but this agreement was actually very good. It had benefits. Courts really won't entertain that. And it's this category, the per se naked agreements, where in addition to civil liability, this is where the DOJ can prosecute criminally and has increasingly brought a focus to prosecuting these types of agreements criminally. So if we go on to the next slide, I think we have another hypothetical here. So in this one, Allie, Betty, and Charlie work for companies that spend a lot of money on recruiting each year, but have found that after all of their efforts, recruits will come for the training, then jump ship to competitors soon after. They decide they could save a lot of money and time if they agree not to recruit trainees at each other's firms, but established employees are considered fair game. Is this a violation? Got a few options here, but I think the right answer is D. Yes, it's a naked agreement here. There's no indication from these facts that A, B, and C have any other collaboration between them, that they have any other relationship. This is just an agreement not to recruit from each other, not to recruit their trainees. Now, they might argue or want to argue that, oh, well, there's benefits here. You know, without this agreement, we wouldn't be incentivized to invest in training our employees and spending all this time helping build their skills. And so there's really a pro-competitive benefit here. But for a per se violation, a court's not gonna entertain that defense. Now, if they had some type of joint venture to invest in training resources and provide certain joint training, this would be a different hypothetical, but that's not what we have here. So moving on, so let's talk a little bit more. We have one point on the next one also, and this is just to note, although agreements are the key for section one, invitations to collude, even if short of an agreement, can still violate the law, and there have been cases brought based on invitations to collude. There have also been, you know, investigations open to see whether those invitations led to actual agreements and claims based on that. So the agencies treat them kind of, you know, they're similar to like an attempt violation, an attempt crime, where if you have all the elements to it, you're inviting somebody to enter into an agreement that would be a per se antitrust violation. Even if it stops short of actually reaching that agreement, you can see risk there. Of course, we see that sometimes more with the agencies than with civil plaintiffs, because if there's not an actual agreement, then there's not a lot of damages for the civil plaintiffs to go after sometimes. On to the next slide, we'll dive a little bit deeper on the ancillary agreements. So whereas the naked agreements are per se illegal, ancillary agreements, the law recognizes, sometimes are good, sometimes can be not so good, and looks at them a little bit more closely. So whether they are a violation or not is determined under a rule of reason analysis, which is a balancing test we'll talk a little bit more about in a minute. But the general standard to be ancillary is that, as we discussed before, the agreement has to be ancillary to a larger legitimate collaboration between employers, and the labor terms have to be reasonably necessary to that collaboration. It can't be, you know, company A is a supplier to company B, they have some business relationship there, and then you just decide blanketly, we're not going to ever hire any of each other's employees, you know, there's no poaching, we're gonna fix wages. It's not carte blanche to do whatever you want. Rather, the no poach or hiring restrictions need to be not broader than reasonably necessary to achieve the efficiencies from a business collaboration. So this is a big part of the analysis here. that we look at is, you know, is it reasonably necessary? Is it reasonably tailored to what you're trying to accomplish here? And in terms of looking at risk for when you're entering into these types of agreements, you know, is it, you don't always want to be right at the line where to get a decision on that, you have to go all the way to trial and get a verdict that it, you know, on the balance was appropriately tailored. You want to be a little bit safe sometimes so that there's not a question that gets past a motion to dismiss. Going on to the next slide, we have yet another hypothetical here. So in the consulting industry, Company A has been supplying consulting services to Company B. Company B employees like Company A so much when it is on the job site that Company B employees keep leaving to join Company A. Bob from Company B is getting annoyed, so Andrew from Company A and Bob agree that Company A will not hire anyone from Company B. Is this a violation? So here, there is a legitimate business relationship between A and B, and there's a legitimate, reasonably necessary argument here for some type of restriction, because maybe if this keeps going on like this and there's not some agreed restriction, they're not going to continue this consulting relationship. They're not going to be able to have it if all of the Company B employees are continuously leaving to Company A. But what we hear here is just a broad agreement that Company A will not hire anyone from Company B. On these facts, you know, we don't know the whole situation, but that sounds like it's pretty broad. That sounds like, you know, the employees from Company A, the consulting employees who are coming in, are probably not interacting with all of the Company B employees. It's probably not all of the Company B employees that are getting this sort of particular preview of Company A's culture that's enticing them to leave. So it's probably broader than necessary in that sense. So, you know, if you're looking at this type of agreement, it's a situation where maybe some type of restriction would be appropriate, but you'd want to think about tailoring it more narrowly. There's also an aspect here where you just have Bob and Andrew talking, which adds a little bit of informality to it, and a little bit of a kind of backroom deal that, you know, stinks of a little bit of extra risk there, whereas, you know, you might want to formalize something and justify the reasons for it in an actual agreement between A and B and make very clear what the terms of it are, rather than just having two executives talking. So going on to the next slide, we'll talk a little bit more about the rule of reason elements. So this is what is applied to those ancillary agreements. Rule of reason, again, in contrast to the per se rule, where it's just illegal, you don't really get to offer much of a defense. Rule of reason claims are under a balancing test and a burden shifting framework. So first, the plaintiff has to prove there's some anti-competitive effect from the restriction that's been agreed to. If they prove that effect, the burden then shifts to the defendant to show some pro-competitive rationale as to why that agreement enabled the legitimate business collaboration, why it had some benefits. This is where you can offer the thing we talked about in the prior two hypos ago, where you couldn't do in a per se violation, say, oh, these restrictions on poaching enable us to invest in training our employees more and has all sorts of benefits in that way. In a rule of reason case, you can make that argument. If you show the pro-competitive rationale, show a benefit there, then the burden shifts back to the plaintiff to show that those same benefits could have been achieved by less restrictive means, to show that, okay, there are some benefits here, but your agreement's still overbroad and should have been narrower. And then one last hypothetical in this section on the next slide deals with specialized employees. So Company A provides services to Company B. They enter into a service contract which contains a provision prohibiting either party from soliciting or hiring each other's employees for 30 days after the employee leaves its employing company. The provision states that it is meant to protect the investment each company made into specializing their employees. An employee from Company B is approached by an unaffiliated recruiter with an opportunity at Company A. Company A interviews the employee, but tells him that they can't hire him because of the contract unless he first leaves Company B. So here we have a few of the elements that weren't present in the prior hypothetical. You have a more formal agreement between the companies. They've kind of documented the reasons for these restrictions. That said, we don't know a lot about the actual business relationship between them and why they've specialized and what services are being provided and if these are the only things A and B do. So I find it a little bit hard to judge from this hypo, you know, whether it is reasonably tailored to what they have or whether it's unreasonably broad. I don't know, Ava, if you have any further thoughts on this one, and I will also say that by way of turning it back over to you for the next section.
Thanks, Kevin. So yeah, I mean, look, I would say that what's good about this is that it is limited, it is tailored, and you have a justification that's written into the formal agreement. So all of those things are protective from a risk perspective. But Kevin's right, we do want to make sure that we understand what are the services that are being provided. You know, is this really something that's necessary to protect the company's interests and business relationship together? And so all of these questions are going to be really fact specific. Before I turn to the next section, I just want to respond. I see we have a question, which is great, and it's a good one. And the question is that it would be helpful to understand in these hypotheticals the difference between in agreements not to hire versus agreements not to solicit. And, you know, are they equally problematic, and how do we need to think about those? And so that's a great question. The short answer is, from the perspective of Section 1, both can be problematic. And so, you know, in the same way that you can't make, for no reason, a naked no hire agreement, you also can't make a naked no solicit or no poach type of agreement. That being said, if you're in kind of the rule of reason ancillary camp, probably a no solicit agreement is going to be more limited and more narrowly tailored, and so could theoretically be more justifiable. So that's the short answer to that question. And now we're going to jump ahead to the next section, which is to give you some. Actually, before we jump into the next section, I'm going to interrupt myself and give you the CLE code, which is 75365. Again, that's 75365.
Okay. And if you're attending by phone, please write that down on the CLE code form that was emailed to you today. I believe if you're attending by WebEx, we've got a different metric for keeping track of people.
Okay, and we can skip ahead. We're going to talk about civil side cases, both government, civil enforcement, as well as private litigation, and we're going to talk about the developments. So first of all, a couple of things to be mindful of. Investigations can begin and often do begin in different ways. So very often, no poach, no hire, wage fixing types of agreements are uncovered by government regulators during completely unrelated investigations. What we have seen, for example, is that there will be an HSR merger review that happens because there are two companies that want to, you know, merge together. Potentially considering some type of acquisition. And in the context of that HSR merger review, there are documents that come to light that show that there was some type of no poach or wage fixing agreement in place, and that will launch a whole new unrelated investigation into that. Just by way of example, we saw that in the U.S. v. Geisinger Health. There was a DOJ challenge to Geisinger's proposed acquisition of a hospital, and that exposed an alleged agreement between the two companies not to poach each other's doctors and nurses. So something to be mindful of. Investigations can often and also do arise from whistleblowers. And so the example that we have here is in the Seaman versus Duke University case. And there you had a Duke professor that alleged a no hire pact between Duke School of Medicine and UNC School of Medicine. And that turned into a massive class action in 2018 that covered 5,500 faculty. So these cases and facts come out in different ways, and that's why it's even more important to make sure all of your HR and employees are properly educated on these issues. Let's move on to the next slide. Okay, DOJ's civil involvement. So prior to 2016, per se cases were not treated criminally. That was a shift that happened about 5 years ago, and actually one that's taken about 5 years for the DOJ to really get serious about, and we'll talk more about that in a bit. But prior to that, and continuing still today, the DOJ can look at these agreements and try to enforce them at the civil level. The DOJ has brought civil antitrust lawsuits for naked no-poach agreements. The INRI high-tech employee antitrust litigation is one of the ones that is most high profile. That was prior to 2016 in the Northern District of California. There have been a few others. Now, because of the DOJ's policy shift, these naked no-poaches are really being looked at more in the criminal context than in the civil context. But the DOJ is also interested in what the plaintiff's bar is doing. So it has filed statements of interest in various private no-poach cases, taking various positions on what it believes the appropriate standard of review should be and things like that. We've seen a whole variety of these cases in the franchise context. The DOJ filed an amicus brief in the 11th Circuit in a franchise case, and in that case, it was really focused on the legal standards that the appeals court should employ for analyzing Section 1 claims. Let's go to the next hypothetical. Okay. So what do we have? We have Company A and Company B are competing. They sell similar goods. Company A is pretty impressed with certain employees that work with Company B, and it reaches out to those employees directly to recruit them. The employees are happy with the opportunity. They leave Company B and they now go work at Company A. Needless to say, this does not make Company B happy. So Company B management contacts Company A to express their frustration with Company A's recruitment habits. Company A decides to slow down its recruitment from Company B to avoid any further conflict. Is there a violation? So, you know, what we're trying to demonstrate through these hypotheticals is that very rarely do you have a clear-cut case and a clear-cut answer. And so you have to think about where the lines are in terms of risky behavior. Here, we don't have, based on these facts, an explicit agreement. It looks like Company A has made its own independent decision to slow down recruiting because, you know, it doesn't want to deal with the conflict. And from a business perspective, that seems to be a more important consideration. But we would want to know more here to really understand the full implications and the real exposure here. What was said by each party on the call? You know, was the decision truly an independent decision? This is the type of discussion that I think falls into a fairly high risk category because we don't know the conversations that could happen around it. We don't know the conversations that are happening internally at each company. And this is the type of thing that plaintiffs could look at and say, this is circumstantial evidence of an agreement. You know, look at these other conversations that happened around this. So I would advise this type of conversation is one that you would not want to have with a competing company. This gets into kind of risky territory, although the answer is not perfectly clear here as to whether or not this would in fact constitute a violation. Let's move to AG and private suits in the fast food industry, which I previewed a little bit before. This is in the franchise context. The state AGs have been investigating civilly no-poach provisions in franchise agreements, especially at fast food chains. There have been a whole host of private class actions that have followed. At least 62 corporate chains have settled these cases nationally. And this is where we see a real disagreement over the proper legal standard. Now, the DOJ's position in these franchise suits is interesting. They are taking the position that the rule of reason should be applied because you do have a vertical relationship between, you know, franchisee and franchisor. You've got no poach agreements that can offer potentially pro-competitive benefits. And so from their perspective, this is not something that would fall into the per se category. Really interestingly, this is where we have a split between how the Department of Justice is viewing this and how state AGs are viewing it. State AGs are taking the position that, in fact, these are per se illegal because where franchisees and franchisors are horizontal competitors, you're in per se illegal territory. So that's the Washington AG. Now, the California AG recognizes that it's a vertical no poach agreement, but under California law, state law in particular, they believe that these are likely per se illegal. And so, you know, what this really demonstrates on the civil side is that there are a lot of unresolved questions here. And you have, you know, different government regulators taking different positions. You have plaintiff lawyers taking different positions. This is an area of law that's really changing quickly and one that we are watching closely as it develops. Let's move to the next slide. Just to give you some context here for what no poach class action settlements can look like. Again, we're talking about civil context, private class actions. The exposure is really astronomical. In the INRI high-tech employment antitrust litigation, you have $435 million of total settlements. INRI animation workers was $170 million. And you can kind of look to see how these go. But the point is non-criminal exposure can be enormous, even in the hundreds of millions of dollars. You know, you're dealing both with settling potentially with government regulators and then also the tag-along class actions that you have to deal with. So high risk, high expense, something that we want to be sure folks are paying attention to so that they can avoid these risks. Let's move to the next slide. As I've mentioned a couple of times, private plaintiffs are continuing to pursue no poach and wage fixing claims in a whole variety of contexts. Some of the cases that are brought follow DOJ or AG investigations, but not all. Some of the cases are brought simply as class actions with no parallel government investigation. There are a number of these cases that have been filed across all industries, and they have gone through the motion to dismiss stage with various levels of success. As you'll see here, we've just identified 4 cases that have that are ongoing just in the past year alone.
Yeah, and I'll note on that one, the Fonseca case is an interesting one because that's a case where first and foremost, it's an age discrimination case, I believe, but the plaintiffs also tacked in no poach claims onto that age discrimination case. The defendants were actually successful at the district court in getting the antitrust claims dismissed, although that's up on appeal now to the Ninth Circuit. But what it shows to me is that this is on the mind of the plaintiff's lawyers. And when you have another employment dispute, there's always a risk that somebody's now going to be thinking about this and trying to tack it on as an additional claim.
Thanks, Kevin. One last hypothetical that we have here before we move to the criminal side of things. And, you know, this hypothetical, which I'll go through in a second, really focuses on the question of to what extent you have to have all market participants participating in a particular agreement in order for there to be a violation. So what's the hypothetical? Mark starts a group text with managers at other companies in his same market. The industry has been struggling recently, and a lot of companies have had to make cuts, they've had to lay off employees, and Mark suggests to the group via text that maybe one way to handle this is to implement a cap on wages for certain employees, which could help many of the companies get through this tough time. Some of the companies agree with Mark and implement the caps on compensation, but others refuse to do so. Is there a violation? And does it matter that the compensation cap was not market-wide? The short answer is that it doesn't matter that the compensation cap was not market-wide, at least from the perspective of whether or not certain companies agreed. And so from that fundamental perspective, companies that would join in this type of an agreement would have some serious potential exposure here. The market issue, you know, maybe would come into play if you were talking about some kind of rule or reason ancillary analysis, but in the context of just competing employers getting together and making this type of an agreement, you know, the fact that the industry is struggling is not a business justification that's sufficient to take this out of violation land. So this would be an extremely risky, problematic exchange to have, even though, you know, Mark is coming at it from a very protective perspective. You know, he wants the best for the industry and from his company. And we see that often where, you know, people are not trying to do something that's harming the industry, that's even harming employees. They think that what they're doing is actually going to be helpful across the board. And even if that's the intent, that's not necessarily protective. And so at the end of the day, agreements like this are very problematic. I'm going to turn it back over to Kevin to talk about the DOJ's first criminal no poach prosecution.
Great. So as Ava previewed earlier, we've seen a big shift in recent years where the DOJ and the FTC, but specifically the DOJ on the criminal side, has adopted a policy in 2016 indicating that they were going to start pursuing criminal charges for naked wage fixing or no poach agreements. Now, there had been actions previously against wage fixing type agreements, but they'd always been brought civilly traditionally, including, so there was a big case we mentioned earlier, the high tech employees, that was around 2010, 2011. And that put a new focus on these types of conduct. And a few years later, you get this new policy statement from the FTC and DOJ. Now, going on to the next slide, that took a few years to percolate. They, you know, announced this policy shift. They were going to start pursuing criminal charges. And only as of December, this past year, did we actually see the first criminal charges brought for wage fixing against an owner of a physical therapist staffing company. Subsequent to that, we've seen two other cases brought, all in the healthcare industry as it happened. And these cases are now percolating through the courts, and it's highly contentious. Going on to the next slide, as these are the first criminal prosecutions for this type of conduct, the defendants certainly don't want to be the first people in history to go to jail for this sort of thing, and are fighting it very hard. They're making some very interesting due process arguments that, you know, what you have here is a shift in policy announced by a prosecutor, but you don't have a shift in the statutes by the legislature. You don't have really a shift from the courts in terms of what conduct is going to be treated as per se or potentially a criminal violation. So they're arguing in these cases that there's not that it's a due process violation to pursue these as a criminal charge. They did not have sufficient notice. And that, you know, most of these are rule of reason claims in some cases that are incompatible with a criminal charge. So that's all still being litigated. We'll see where that goes. And there are some differences in the cases. Some of them allege a pure kind of wage fixing case. Some of them are based on one has a no solicit type agreement that is alleged to be a naked no solicit, but is, you know, maybe a little bit less extreme than the allegation of a straight wage fix. So we'll see if those get different treatment. We'll see how the law develops there. Moving on to the next slide, you know, these first three cases have all been kind of in the healthcare industry. You know, this is the first volley. We're expecting to see more. The DOJ and the Antitrust Division leadership have been making speeches, giving information out that indicates they have investigations ongoing in a number of other sectors, including online advertising, financial services, the food and beverage industry. You know, we'll see where that goes, but this continues to be a high priority area. And we're expecting to see more. And kind of moving on to the next slide, we just have a quote here from the current head, acting head of the antitrust division about this, how this remains a priority. And I think what we've seen, you know, across the last couple administrations, and we'll see it, expect to see it with the Biden administration, is that antitrust remains a high priority area. I think we've all seen there's a large and increasing bipartisan consensus that antitrust is something both parties care about and are trying to strongly enforce. And I think in the labor area, we've seen increasing bipartisan focus on that as well. I mean, you've certainly seen a shift in the Republican Party priorities to be more kind of pro-labor, pro-worker in some of their initiatives, and Democrats have long advanced those types of policies. So we're very much expecting this to continue to be a hot area with a lot of action through this administration. So we have one more hypothetical for you in this section.
And just before you move to the hypothetical, Kevin, let me just chime in with one more point, which, you know, for those who are not super familiar with criminal antitrust prosecutions, we've alluded to this a bit, but there is serious exposure here, not just for the companies in terms of criminal fines, you know, criminal plea agreements, criminal findings, but really for the individuals who have entered into these agreements on behalf of companies. Because DOJ is pursuing them criminally, executives, HR professionals, you know, all our Marys and Charlies in these various hypotheticals face jail time. And the DOJ has made clear in other naked Section 1 violation contexts, things like price fixing and bid rigging, that they do intend to send individuals who enter into these agreements to jail. And we've seen sentences, you know, upwards of 2 years and even more in some circumstances. So there's a real serious individual risk that people should be aware of in this context.
And in the hypothetical here, we've got Sam, who works in HR at Company A. Apparently she was hired even though her name doesn't begin with A. She is friends with Tim, who works in HR at Company B. Company A and Company B have stores located in the same shopping center in a city that has historically been difficult to hire in. Sam and Tim were discussing over the phone how difficult recruitment has been for their retail stores. To make things easier, they decide not to recruit or hire salespeople from one another. Hopefully at this point in the presentation, this is a pretty clear hypo. This is a naked no poach agreement or no hire agreement. There's no indication of any other collaboration between Company A and Company B, and you just have a telephone deal between two people who work in HR. So this is a situation where, you know, if followed through, Sam and Tim could face individual criminal exposure, and certainly the companies could face both criminal and civil exposure. I know we focus on HR people here, but a lot of times in a, you know, retail business, retail hiring decisions might be made by store managers. It highlights that it's important to get your kind of compliance training and information down to the people who are making these decisions at the kind of line level, who could just pick up the phone and call somebody else and kind of not thinking reach this type of agreement and expose themselves and the company to a great deal of liability. So as we talk about compliance best practices, I'll turn it back over to Ava to go in a little more depth.
Okay, so best practices number one. Investigate. Look at your companies right now and think about and identify whether there are any agreements that are risky. Of course, if you have naked, no poach, no hire, wage fixing agreements, those should be ended very clearly and quickly. But you should also look at agreements that may come up in this ancillary context. context where it's an agreement that's attached to some other type of collaboration. And you want to make sure that all of those are A, number one, really necessary, and number two, narrowly tailored to achieve whatever that pro-competitive purpose is of that of the broader collaboration. So you want to think about things like, you know, what is the specific venture to which the agreement is ancillary? Let's document paper why the agreement is reasonably necessary to achieve the pro-competitive venture. Identify with reasonable specificity the employees who are subject to the agreement, right? So are, do we really need to restrict hiring or with respect to every employee in the company, or are we really talking about some subset that's relevant to this ancillary agreement? Termination dates or termination events, okay? Let's not have these agreements go on forever indefinitely. That makes them far more risky. And memorialize the agreement in writing and have it signed by all parties. So let's move on to the next slide. The second point to remember is ensure that the HR department and anyone else that's involved in decisions about hiring, about wage setting, about compensation benefits, have specific guidance on the do's and don'ts and understand the risk that's involved. We want to reinforce the importance of making unilateral decisions in connection with hiring and compensation practices. And that if there are any restrictions that are placed on employees, they are reasonably related, they are narrowly tailored. And so you really want to train your HR and any other relevant professionals and executives involved in recruitment to make sure they understand the red flags here and the proper lines and boundaries. Finally, think about potential alternatives to these types of agreements. You know, employers can enter into vertical agreements directly with employees if the restrictive covenant serves a legitimate business purpose. I'll note that this is, you know, this is a labor issue. It's state by state, so you really have to look at the state laws that are in play. But, you know, you could have, as part of an employment contract, some reasonable restrictions. Again, they have to be reasonable, but at least that takes it out of the context where you're talking about company to company and you're talking about, you know, an employer to employee contract where the employee is aware of the restrictions and they're narrowly tailored. I can't highlight enough that you still need to exercise a lot of caution and really look at the relevant laws on a state-by-state basis before including these types of provisions in your employment contracts, but there is a way to do it. And so the questions to think about is, you know, are there other ways to accomplish what you want to accomplish without entering into a no-poach agreement? That really concludes our presentation. I see that we have at least one question, so let me pull that up. Can you provide any guidance on international enforcement? So that's a great question. I would say the U.S. is ahead of these particular issues. So it is very much, I think, the riskiest in the United States. I will make a couple of points. Number one is that if you are a global company and you have decisions that are being made outside of the U.S., but those decisions influence or impact hiring, compensation, employees in the U.S. market, you are potential, you know, this is something that's relevant to you. So just because the rules of, you know, interaction are being set somewhere else outside of the U.S. doesn't mean that your company isn't going to be implicated and isn't going to face risk if it's operating within the United States. So that's kind of point one. Point two is it's very much jurisdictional right now. So different countries are taking different approaches. I know off the top of my head, for example, that Canada doesn't have the same type of restrictions, but it's really something that you should look at in each jurisdiction where you have operations so that you understand what the international implications are. So far, the US is the one who's taking the most aggressive approach. That's not surprising. I mean, typically what you'll have in the antitrust space is the US, you know, kind of taking a stand in a particular area, and then you can then other jurisdictions may follow. So we do expect that other foreign jurisdictions are going to take positions and develop their own law in this area.
I believe we've seen some cases in Spain, I think, has brought a few cases, and in Europe, we've seen them kind of at the member state national level. I'm not aware yet of the European Commission doing a broad investigation, but certainly, as Eva said, there's cross-pollination of ideas and a lot of discussion between the different enforcers.
Any other questions or comments before we conclude? Well, thank you, everybody. On behalf of Winston and Strawn's Antitrust Practice Group, we appreciate your attendance today in our webinar program. Just as a reminder, the CLE code is 75365, and the CLE activity evaluation form was included in the email that we sent out yesterday to those who have registered. You need to complete that if you want credit for today's presentation. We will also send a follow-up email with a link to the presentation slides and our contact information. So if you have any questions that come up after you've thought about this, please don't hesitate. Feel free to reach out. This really is a hot topic right now. There's a lot of risk around this area, so it's something that everyone ought to be thinking about. Thanks so much for your time.